We're children of the wind, blown across the earth, pieces of a heart scattered worlds apart. So far from those we love, all the children. Someday to see all the children of my children are there, and they're very, very noisy running through my kitchen. And we've been there for a lifetime, and I know they will never be children of the wind.
That is Children of the Wind. You probably guessed that was the title of the song. That was Children of the Wind. It's from the musical Rags. Rags is playing right now at the Goodspeed in East Haddam through December 10th. And with me is one of the creators of Rags. It is the composer, director, lyricist. He's not all those things on Rags, but these are things that he has been. Stephen Schwartz. Stephen Schwartz, you know him. You've known him all your life, probably. I'm not a young man, and I've known him all my life through Godspell, which was when I was in high school, and Pippin right around the time I started college, and then obviously through this incredible string of wonderful musicals, including, of course, Wicked, and then Disney musicals, and things like Enchanted. So it is very exciting to be in the New Haven studios of Yale University. Stephen Schwartz with you. This isn't the first go-round for Rags, but it's also not the same Rags that has appeared at other times. You're calling it a revisal. What's a revisal?
A revisal is in contrast to what one would call a revival, where basically you put on the show that existed before. Sometimes you do a little bit of tweaking and a little bit of moving things around, but in this case, all the creators of the show felt that if we were going to try to come up with a version that really worked, we needed to go back pretty much to the drawing board and just start again and use eventually what worked in the new conception and the new version, but not be tied down to anything.
Give people kind of a feeling for this story. It's a story of immigrants in the early 20th century, told particularly through the story of one particular immigrant, Rebecca Herskovitz, who is a survivor of and fleeing from a pogrom.
Well, that's exactly correct. It focuses mostly on the experience of Jewish immigrants coming to the country in this case between 1909 and 1911. And the initial impetus for the show was a kind of follow-up to the experiences of the people of Anatevka in Fiddler on the Roof when they left that village. What happened to them when they came to America? There are no characters in Rags who are carryovers from Fiddler on the Roof, but it's basically that experience. I think Fiddler ends in 1905. This picks up a little bit later, as I say, in 1909. But most of the characters in it are Jewish immigrants. There is one prominent character who is an Italian immigrant.
Another play that it kind of connects to in an odd way is as I'm sure you know, when Jerome Robbins first approached Arthur Lorentz and ultimately Bernstein about West Side Story, it was really East Side Story. It was going to be the Lower East Side. It was going to be about, I think, Irish and Jewish gangs or rivalries, right?
Yes. As far as I know, when it was East Side Story, that's exactly what it was. And then they discovered that there was a more, for that time, contemporary kind of gang warfare going on the West Side, right where I now live in Hell's Kitchen.
Well, but so here, so this musical, you're on Orchard Street or thereabouts at various times, and there's huge amounts of discomfort. There's a little boy in the play who discovers pretty quickly that being one block out of the way can be very dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. It was a dangerous time. There were different neighborhoods, and particularly for the newer immigrants. It was dangerous to encounter the immigrants who'd been there a little bit longer. You know, it seems to be a theme that runs through our country and we're certainly dealing with now.
Right. There's a sense – we're about to hear this song, Greenhorns, from this. There's sort of a sense that there are all kinds of predatory forces. I mean, we encounter our protagonists in this play as they're on the boat coming over and getting off the boat. And yes, there are all kinds of sources of predation ranging from those more recently settled groups of immigrants who have maybe, you know, a 5-10 year head start on these. And then there is also this other settled class of people who doubtless don't consider themselves immigrants at all. We'll hear a little bit from them in this song, Greenhorns.
Another load of greenhorns fresh off the boat. Another wave of refugees to fill the mills and factories. A little grist for the capital system. It's a bunch of grease balls greasing the wheels. A little oil for the machine. Greenhorns, ship them.
So the one thing I want to say right away, I said it to you when you came in, I really like this musical. And I went on Friday night and I was tired and I was like, drive all the way down to East Hanna. I worked all day. And then I got there and I really, there's the Charles Strauss, your collaborator, these very lush and interesting melodies. The story that you and the through your lyrics and the book tell, it is poignant. I got verklempt at the end, which is, you know, that's what you want.
Exactly.
But this... I mean, maybe another reason that I went in with the wrong set of expectations is this show struggled in its maiden voyage, right? In 1986, you do it on Broadway, and what happens?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a show that we could never really figure out how to get together when we first did it. You know, this happens with shows from time to time, and more often than not, they then get consigned to the dust heap of Broadway history as misses or near misses. But over time, I think largely due to Charles's score, because the music is really great, there's been interest in the show. There have been various attempts at revivals, but they were what I would call the rearranging deck chairs school of revival, where things get moved around, but it's basically on the same ship that's going down eventually. And so it was great when Goodspeed approached us and gave us the opportunity really to rethink this. I think, you know, by that time we had a number of ideas about what had not worked originally or why the show hadn't come together fully. And then there were two very important new collaborators who joined us. One was the director, Rob Ruggiero, who had a very clear concept of how he wanted to approach the show. And then because our original book writer, Joseph Stein, had passed away, David Thompson, the writer of, among other shows, The Scottsboro Boys, came in. And he and Rob really came up with a fresh approach. And that allowed Charles and me and the others to kind of look at the show in a whole new way.
So not that you want to dwell in 1986 at all, but it was kind of there's an interesting thing that happened on what I think was ultimately the last night of the show. One of your players, Lonnie Price, I think it was, came to the stage, I guess to the apron of the stage, and said to the audience, meet us outside under the marquee. You want to tell that story?
Well, you know, I've heard the story, but I wasn't actually there.
Yeah.
But I guess, you know, they did a little protest march down Broadway in an attempt to keep the show open, though. Of course, that was a pretty naive hope. But I think what it indicated was the devotion of the cast themselves and the people who were already aficionados of the show towards it. But I have to tell you the truth, as an author, I was looking at something that I realized did not yet work.
It didn't work. But I'm wondering also, you were very familiar at that time with success. And by the age of 26, you were this wunderkind and maybe not as familiar with a show that closes after 18 previews and 4 showings. Was that hard? I mean, how did you deal with that? Did you go out and get drunk? Did you go lie down on the floor for 5 days? What'd you do?
Well, I think I was pretty depressed for a while. Sure. But But what didn't, I think I would have felt worse if I had felt that it was unjust. Mm. If I had felt this was a great show and why the hell didn't they get it? Mm-hmm. I think all of us knew that structurally we had not really solved the show, and there were great things in it that excited such devotion, but the show itself had not coalesced completely. And over the years, because, you know, one continues to learn, I came to some conclusions as to why that had been the case.
It's, you know, I was running my eye down the cast list today from that original cast in 86. There's some interesting names there and people that have had ongoing associations with you. Gabriel Barre. Do you say Barre?
Yeah, Gay Barre was in it.
So, and he's like, hasn't he created some kind of Stephen Schwartz thing?
Yeah, like he did a very successful review of mine called Magic to Do, which is actually on the Princess Cruise Lines and may find its way onto land because it's been so well received. But Gabe's become a very well respected director.
Works at the Goodspeed a lot.
At Goodspeed a lot. Of course, you know, the cast featured, you know, Judy Kuhn before she was as well known as she is now. In fact, as you said, Lonnie Price, Terry Mann. I mean, it wasn't the cast's fault. Let's just put it that way.
Right. And so a lot of those people, I mean, I think Terry Mann, who's doing a lot of work in Connecticut these days, but obviously became a big Broadway star too. He's been the king in Pippin since then.
Yes,
right?
he was in the wonderful Diane Paulus revival of Pippin. He played Charlemagne in that.
I saw the production of Pippin. In fact, I think I ran into you at the Goodspeed, the one that had Mickey Dolenz as the king.
Oh, you've worked
with a monkey.
That's true, yes. A monkey with a double E.
Right, a monkey with a double E. I want to talk a little bit about the messages in this play. And it does seem as though obviously this play was conceived at another time, but as it's a revisal, so you've had a chance to reconceive it. I don't want to do any spoilers at all. I do want a lot of people listening to go and see this. But so it's very interesting things done with production and art direction in this. At the end, there's kind of a collage of immigrants that kind of drops down in front of the players. It's very beautiful. But, I mean, it's hard to miss the message here, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, we are living at a time where the show actually is more relevant than it was in the 80s, where the whole issue of immigration was not as controversial and certainly not as much in the news and in the forefront. One of the things that the authors, including myself, discovered when we went back to the show and did some research was how similar the attitude towards immigrants was at this time. There was literally a congressman who wanted to build a wall to keep them out. There were a lot of protests. There were political cartoons all about how the culture of America was going to be destroyed by this wave of Eastern European immigrants coming in, that America was not going to be the same country after they came in. And of course, we're dealing with people who are feeling the same way now. It's interesting that many of those people who are feeling the same way now are, in fact, the grandchildren of these immigrants who others wanted to keep out. But someone once famously said, you know, we live in the United States of amnesia.
Well, you know, it's odd how theater has anticipated this moment. And I'm like, without even trying, you know, right away, there's this show that's up right now, but it was written in the past. Hamilton, a couple of times, they say, you know, immigrants, we get the job done. Hadestown, which I think was conceived of by Anais Mitchell before the Trump run, has a song in it called Why We Build the Wall. Mm-hmm. That it just sounds like it could have been out of a Trump campaign speech. And you sort of wonder about that. Like, why would there be such prescience? And I wonder if it's partly because musicals, what we call the American musical theater, is the work of Jerome Kern and George Gershwin and Irving Berlin, this form was kind of created by people who were either immigrants or immediately the sons and daughters of immigrants.
Yeah, well, I think that may be why this particular topic has been being dealt with always, but certainly contemporarily, and therefore maybe seems a bit ahead of its time. You know, but I think in general, musicals tend to try to deal with things that are in the air and in the culture. So, you know, you get shows like, you know, Fun Home, coming sort of in the midst of or slightly before, you know, HB2 in North Carolina. And, you know, it's not unusual for musicals, which is odd because they take so long to write.
Right.
It's not like you look at a headline. It's not like you're doing Law and Order and you look at a headline and you think, oh, next week's show could be based on that headline. Musicals take 5 years at best to create, and yet they do often seem to be right on the cusp of the times.
Right. Law and Order can be ripped from today's headlines. Today's headlines are ripped from musicals. The musical already happened, and now reality is kind of catching up. So another thing that you're really plunging into, I mean, the reason this thing is called Rags is it's about the garment trade to a certain degree. It's about people trying to make a pretty meager living at first in the equivalent of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, but also just doing stitching out of tiny little apartments, putting dresses together. And so we're going to hear a song called Fabric of America, in which you attempt basically to take the process by which something like that's assembled and make it musical.
First is the baster. Now, Bella, that's you. Stitch one piece wrong, it's a wreck. Assemble the garment, remembering you are meant to make sure the sleeve ain't the neck.
The baster.
Next is the stitcher who works the machine.
Oh, that's me, finally, hurrah!
Mr. Hurrah, hey, don't think you're so grand. Just try to see, you don't sew through your hand.
The baster,
the stitcher,
together we work. The fabric of America. Stitch, paddle, stitch, stitch, paddle, stitch, stitch, paddle, stitch.
First of all, I mean, was that – it almost sounds like that might have been a fun song to write. I mean,
it was really fun to write, yeah, because I didn't really know how these things were assembled, how piecework worked. One of the differences in the current show is that, in fact, a great deal of it takes place in this one tenement apartment where they basically have a home sweatshop. Rob and Tom, when they were Tom, by the way, is the nickname for David Thompson. So I have to remember to call him David officially. Rob and David, when they were researching the show, went down to the Tenement Museum on the Lower East Side, and they actually found an apartment, and they thought, this is the apartment in which this show should take place. The design of the apartment is based on that. And then we did research and learned what kind of work would be done there and how they would make these dresses. This is quite different than the plot, the story in the original show. But what was nice for me is that actually that's the story of my grandmother. When she started out, she was in the rag trade on the Lower East Side, and she became a dress designer and did fairly well.
Another thing that's happening in the current version of this play, and as I say, I don't want to do any spoilers, so all I'll say is a character dies at some point in the play. I won't tell you who.
Well, you know, all good musicals, somebody's got to die.
Well, that's actually not
the
really
Rodgers
true.
And Hammerstein rule. Somebody got to die.
I could come up with exceptions to that.
No, of course, there are exceptions.
But was that a decision you made in this iteration, this revival?
No. That was always the case. I feel we've made better, more poignant, and more appropriate in terms of its centrality to the story. We've made better use of the incident than we did originally.
We're talking to Stephen Schwartz right now, by the way, if you're just tuning in. Before we go to a break, why did you do this? I mean, it's just a lot more work. You got other projects going. We'll be talking about some of those other projects. You could keep busy. You don't have to go to East Haddam and try to get this play back together again that you've already had experiences with. What was so important to you that you're willing to do this?
It seemed like a unique opportunity actually to see if we could solve the problem of this show. A bunch of things came together. The fact that Goodspeed, which is a great place to develop shows, was interested. The fact that they were willing to bring in a new book writer and the team, the original team, therefore, was ready really to re-examine the show. It just seemed after all, as I said, these sort of rearranging deck chairs attempts, mm-hmm. it seemed too good an opportunity to pass up. It did make for a rather complicated schedule for me, but I'm glad I undertook it.
Right, and we should be clear. This is sort of the Goodspeeds idea, and then they pitched it at Rob Ruggiero, and you guys initially said, nah, I don't think so, right? I mean, you weren't necessarily jumping at the chance to do this.
Well, yeah, I mean, just to speak for myself, I did turn it down initially because I had seen other attempts to resuscitate Rags, and I felt that the show didn't work and there was no point in doing it unless it was really going to be revised. But then when Goodspeed was not only willing to do that but enthusiastic about doing that, then, you know, we jumped in with both feet.
Also, and I have to say this on the air because he's very neurotic about these things, Rob Ruggiero is just a terrific director, and he's done a nice job with this, and he did an incredible job with Next to Normal last year.
Which I saw, which
yeah.
was
well,
an excellent
show?
Yeah, it was an excellent production.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I liked the Broadway-scale production, but I liked this better, the very intimate style that Rob achieved was terrific. So, all right, so I said that, Rob, okay. we're going to take a little break. Oh, we're going to come back with more Stephen Schwartz.
The baster. Now, Bella, that's you. Stitch one piece wrong, it's a wreck. Assemble the garment, remembering you are meant.
Out of the ruins and rubble, out of the smoke, out of our night of struggle, can we see a ray of hope? One pale thin ray reaching for the day. We can build a beautiful city. Yes, we can. Yes, we can.
That's 100 Parish singing Beautiful City. I'm here in New Haven with Stephen Schwartz, the man who gave you Godspell, the man who gave you Pippin, the man who gave you Wicked, the magic show, tons of other things. Rags, right now, his creation alongside Charles Strauss and several different book writers is now, and directed by the great Rob Ruggiero, that's twice, is now running at the Goodspeed in East Haddam. I think it's running through December 10th. Get your tickets now. We'll also talk about some other projects he's doing. But so there's a character in Rags, Stephen Schwartz, named Ben, and Ben just knows in his bones he's a songwriter. He just absolutely can feel it. I mean, he barely has access to a piano. He doesn't even know that sheet music can be printed up and sold so that you can make money from writing your songs. At some point in your life, were you Ben? Did you sort of feel in your bones that you were a songwriter?
Well, it was something I always wanted to do since I was a kid. I did know that people could be professional songwriters because my parents had a friend who was a professional songwriter named George Kleinsinger, who wrote, among other things, Tubby the Tuba and Ballad for Americans and a couple of other things that back in my childhood were popular recordings. So it was actually George who recognized in me a musical ability and suggested to my parents maybe they might consider getting me piano lessons.
How old were you when that happened?
6 years old.
6 years old, yeah. Wow. And so, I mean, look, we're kind of from the same generation. One possible musical path that was suggested maybe more frequently to most of us, it was something closer to what's on the radio, right? We all want to be rock and roll stars. Maybe you wanted to be Jerry Lee Lewis on the piano. I don't know. How did you wind up doing what you do instead of that?
No, I didn't actually want to be Jerry Lee Lewis. I always wanted to be, you know, Rodgers and Hammerstein and Bach and Harnick. And partly it was because George Kleinsinger, whom I just mentioned, was working on a show, an adaptation of a successful recording he had done called Archie and Mehitabel. The show was called Shinbone Alley, and it had a very brief run on Broadway. It featured at the time a chorus of dancing cats, which was roundly ridiculed.
And some cockroaches, I assume, too.
Yes, Archie's, there was, in fact,
Archie's a cockroach.
A singing cockroach and a chorus of dancing cats, which critics couldn't understand why people would want to come to the theater and see a bunch of cats dancing, demonstrating the importance of timing. But yeah, when I was, I guess by the time it got to Broadway, I was maybe 8 or 9, and my parents took me to see it. It was my first Broadway show, and that was really the moment I thought, well, this is the world I want to live in. This is the thing I want to do. So I didn't become like most of my generation. You know, I wasn't Paul Simon or James Taylor or Joni Mitchell or whatever, that sort of singer-songwriter route, aside from the fact that I'm not as good a singer as they are also. But that was never what I was interested in.
And do you remember your first song, the first song that you wrote where you thought, I just wrote a song?
I do. I used to do little puppet shows at home with my sister using stuffed animals and her dolls, and we would make up shows. And I wrote a show about a dog who ran away from home. It was a, you know, deeply tragic event. And there was a song in it called Little Lullaby that was sung to the dog. Whether it was my first song or not, it's the only one from that time that I remember. So, yeah, then I must have been, as I say, around 6 or 7.
Right. So, I mean, skipping vastly ahead, Godspell, okay, so Godspell, when I graduated from high school in 1972, which means I know a lot of the songs from Godspell. I mean, they were on the radio.
They were, which was amazing.
I know a lot of the songs that weren't on the radio, too. But and that seems, you know, for a guy named Stephen Schwartz, not necessarily the material that I would have, one might have expected you to plunge into right away, right? This is sort of a story that, well, yeah.
Well, Godspell began as a gig for me, to be perfectly obvious. I had done an early college version of the show that became Pippin when I was at Carnegie Mellon. And when I graduated and came to New York, I was sort of hawking Pippin around. I managed to get an agent. She managed to bring me to play for various producers. Among the producers she brought me to were Edgar Lansbury and, let me try and say that more clearly, Edgar Lansbury and Joseph Beru. And they were not interested at all in Pippin, but about 6 or 9 months later, they came across Godspell, oddly enough, also by Carnegie Mellon students, which was playing off Broadway at the Cafe La Mama. And they decided maybe this had commercial possibility, but it needed an actual score. Mm. And I've always believed that they called every known composer in New York, all of whom said no, and they finally, in desperation, turned to that kid who had that strange musical about Charlemagne. But Edgar swears that I was their first choice. Anyway, they called me. I went to the Cafe La Mama, and I saw the show, and said I'd like to, you know, of course I'd like to write the songs for it. And they said, great, we go into rehearsal in 5 weeks. Go.
No problem. A lot of American show business, as we knew it, say, in the 1980s, was born in a production of Godspell in Toronto, right? I mean, just so many people that we came to know and love.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it was it was what became basically Second City TV. It mm-hmm. was all these great comedians, you know, Marty Short and Andrea Martin and Gene Levy, Gilda Radner, who was not SATV but went on to Saturday Night Live. It was really our funniest production ever, and also Victor Garber was the lead.
Victor was the lead, and then there was some weird guy named Paul Schaefer. What was he doing?
Yes, Paul Schaefer came in to play a couple of auditions for people who were, you know, trying to get cast in the show. And I heard him play and immediately stopped him in the hall and said, would you be interested in being our musical director? And so we hired him to be musical director for the show and then subsequently brought him to New York. And then, you know, he got Saturday Night Live also and went on to very, very well-deserved fame and glory.
You know, I said that in high school, I mean, I wound up learning most of the songs from Godspell because people did. People had the album. It was an album then. And it was a record, and we listened to it. But this has happened over and over again to you with your work. I would say more than people who typically write for the Broadway stage, your music is in the ears of young people. And there's a whole generation of girls – between the ages of 10 and 15 or something, for whom Wicked was this just incredibly powerful statement. Not just a great musical that they liked that had cool songs to sing, but a musical about what? About not fitting in, about discovering kind of, it's the old Hans Christian Andersen Ugly Ducklies.
Exactly, you know, right, yeah. The out, you know, I do like to do shows about outcasts or people who consider themselves outcasts and are trying to figure out how to exist in the world. And it's just a theme that's always attracted me, and it does seem to be one that resonates for a lot of audiences.
Right, and Pippin has that to a certain degree. And like, there's a song like Extraordinary where he's just singing about how bored he is doing anything that he's supposed to be doing, which pretty much describes most people's adolescence and possibly beyond. But what's it like? I mean, you can't underestimate the strength of some of this material, how important. Not actually, let's just play also a song from Enchanted, all right? This is another example of a song that is very, very familiar to a generation of young girls who've just been kind of knocked out by, I mean, not just young girls. I mean, I'm a guy. I like the song. You know? I'm not young. But so anyway, this is a little tune from Enchanted. Oh, it's it's That's How You Know.
To show her Kanika, don't treat her like a mind reader. Each day do something to lead her to believe you love her.
Everybody wants to live happily ever after. Everybody wants to know their true love is true. How do you know?
How does she know that you love her?
He loves
how you.
How do you know?
How does she know that you love her?
You know, Stephen Schwartz, I mean, whether it's this from Enchanted or, I mean, I went to see Wicked on Broadway when Chenoweth and Idina Menzel were in it. And it's, you see what this is. You know, you see the, what the, I mean, there are all these cliches like female empowerment and stuff like that. But it must be kind of exciting for you to see these girls for whom these musicals are, make incredibly powerful but also very much fun statements.
Well, sure. I mean, the fact that work that I've done, and obviously it's not just me, with my collaborators, has such resonance for people and in some ways provides motivation for them in their lives or helps them get over issues that are bothering them. I mean, to be honest, that's not why you write shows, mm-hmm. but when something sort of has that ancillary impact, it's you know, nothing is more gratifying for a writer than that.
It's not why you write shows, but in the case of Wicked, right, you had this kind of source material, the Gregory Maguire thing, right?
Yeah.
And looking at that, you had to know, well, first of all, this is a counter narrative. This is, you know, this is Wizard of Oz told from an opposite perspective, from the quote unquote villainous perspective, but obviously somebody who doesn't think of herself at all as a villain. And you probably saw also those elements, those, yes, you're misunderstood. Yes, nobody gets you. Yes, you are exploited at times and ridiculed by the more popular people. You must have known at least that those elements were there. Was that part of
what attracted you? Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's what was attractive about the material in the first place. You know, I basically first heard about Wicked from a friend of mine who was reading the novel, the folk singer Holly Neer, who mentioned to me in a very casual way, oh, I'm reading this really interesting book, and it's called Wicked, and it's kind of the Oz story from the Wicked Witch's point of view. And from that title and that one sentence, mm-hmm. I immediately knew that that was something that I wanted to do because it was so thematically in my wheelhouse and what interests me. And of course, that's part of it, the taking a character who is perceived in one way and understood in another way and looking at it in from a different point of view of reality. I mean, I feel like I tend to do shows and stories that are like that in many, many instances.
Let's hear a little bit of the song Popular from Wicked, and then I'll make a kind of interesting point about that. Well, I don't know if it'll be interesting or not, but anyway, here's Popular.
A point.
We have to think of celebrated heads of state or especially great communicators. Did they have brains or knowledge? Don't make me laugh. They were popular. Please, it's all about popular. It's not about aptitude, it's the way you're viewed. So it's very shrewd to be very, very popular. Like me.
This is another little Stephen Schwartz lyric that has a peculiar resonance here in 2017. I'll let people connect those dots. One of the ironies of this show is, I mean, not to excite every creator's neurosis over reviews, but boy, if you read the reviews to the show, you wouldn't understand, have any idea what was going to happen, that it was going to become this incredibly dominant force on Broadway. Reviewers seemed not to get it.
Reviewers have never – I've never been a critic's darling. Mm. You know, I have never gotten a good review in the New York Times for any show I've ever done. For whatever reason, the way that I write and the way that I hear things is not always in sync with the way the critical community responds to things or analyzes things. And, of course, there was a period of time when that was very upsetting and hurtful to me. But, you know, after a while, I just feel like, well, there's nothing I can do about this. I can't second guess what I'm doing to try and please the critic for the New York Times. So I basically have to write what, you know, what speaks to me and what I believe in, and hope enough other people find it entertaining or resonant or meaningful that they go and see it.
Yeah, well, there is a little bit of having a last laugh here too. I mean, it's a better story, really, that Wicked did what it did.
Listen, sure, but I would love to have, you know, shows open and be treated like, you know, Lin-Manuel Miranda or Stephen Sondheim, you know, both of whom are writers I enormously admire. You know, I'm sorry that hasn't happened for me, but you know, again, it can't be something you worry about. I just keep working.
You're going to be fine. while you're working on this, while you're doing this revisal of the show Rags at the Goodspeed in East Haddam, you've also got another project, and that's Prince of Egypt, right? Which is Prince of Egypt conceived as obviously an animated movie. Now is maybe going to make a transition to the stage before you get into that. Because it's fun playing all these clips here. So let's hear When You Believe. This is from Prince of Egypt.
In this time of fear, when prayers so often proved in vain, hope seemed like the summer birds too swiftly flown away. Yet now I'm standing here,
I'm standing
with heart
here.
So full, I can't explain, seeking faith and speaking words I never thought I'd say. There can be miracles when you believe.
So the plan now is to rip this thing off the animated screen and throw it up on a stage, right?
It is on a stage. It's on a stage at TheaterWorks in Mountain View, California, which is basically Silicon Valley. Earlier, I alluded to the fact that Rags happening at Goodspeed made my schedule a little complicated because these two shows had their first preview on the same night, 3,000 miles apart. So I have been a little bit of a airplane yo-yo,
right.
But it's gone very well. It's running there in California. It's been quite well received, and you know, we'll see where it goes from here.
When you write for animation on the screen, or kind of semi-animation in the case of Enchanted, more live action, but for these things that have this kind of Disney ethos too, do you find that you're writing – is a song just a song, whether it's on Broadway or on a screen, or are you writing to a different aesthetic?
Well, to some extent, a musical theater song is a musical theater song, and I would differentiate it from – a pop song, because musical theater songs are story-driven, character-driven, need to advance something about the story being told. That being said, whether it's in an animated feature or a live-action movie musical or on stage or on television, the job is kind of the same, but there are obviously different considerations with the different media.
I mean, Alan Menken, who you're collaborating with, kind of invented this particular style of Disney music. He and Howard Ashman initially collaborating, you guys collaborating now. How do you and Alan Menken work? Do you sit in a room at a piano and bark things at each other, or do you you know, email each other ideas, or what do you do?
A bit of both, but we do tend to be in the room together. Alan lives quite near me, mm-hmm. and he's a good friend of mine. I mean, we play tennis together, we have dinner together, and I usually go over to his studio, and we talk about what the assignment is for this specific song. I like to bring a title if I can, because I know that's helpful for Alan and for me to jump from. But we do tend to start with music. We go music first, and then the lyrics catch up.
Do you ever, whether it's with Charles Strauss or Menken or anybody else, when you're a lyricist as opposed to writing the entirety of the song, do any of your musical ideas bleed into these songs, or is there a firewall?
There's not a firewall, because I will say to Alan something like, could the melody go up here? Or it'd be great if there were like some whole note here or something for her to hold a, you know, hold a word out or whatever. But it's never more specific than that. I don't sort of elbow him away from the keyboard and say, what if it went like this? And I wouldn't presume to do so. I mean, I like Alan's music very much. Obviously, I respond strongly to it. Charles is an amazing composer. And yeah, I mean, I'll express my opinion, but the truth is they'll express their opinions about my lyrics as well. And I'll always try to adjust if there's something that they don't like. And often they make suggestions that I'm happy to incorporate.
Do you like writing music? I mean, is it in the moment? I interviewed Kendra and Ebb years ago, and they were doing a show at the Goodspeed, actually, called Reviving the Happy Time. Mm. And I was just asking them about times when directors say, you know what, this song is not working. Could you go write another song? And like, how does that feel? And they said, well, we love it. We're never happier than when somebody sends us away to go sit in a room at a piano and try to write a song. Is that how it feels for you, or is it hard work?
It's certainly work, but I enjoy it. I mean, I'm very, very lucky. I'm one of the very few people on earth who gets to make a living and have a vocation that would have been my avocation. I mean, I would have done this for free and as a hobby if it didn't become my profession. You know, I do want to say that the cliche of the director saying, this song doesn't work, go and write another one, is not really what happens. Usually the writers are there saying, I don't think the song works. I think we have to take another try
right.
at it. It's very rare when you sort of get sent to your room to try and do better.
So you don't think Harold Prince threw those two songs out of company until Sondheim wrote Being Alive? I mean, supposedly.
I would suspect that Steve was the impetus behind changing the song, though I still frankly think that Marry Me a Little is a better song than Being Alive, but that's me.
Yeah, they're both good songs, though.
They both are.
Happily Ever After and Hell, maybe a little too dark. All right, so we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back with more Stephen Schwartz. His musical, his and Charles Strauss's musical, Rags, is up at the Goodspeed. Go get your tickets. Everybody wants to live happily ever
after. Today's show was produced by Josh Nalea, with help from me, Kyone Wolf, and our intern, Sarah Bly. The part of Bill Curry was played by Ben Vereen. On tomorrow's show, the beauty and potential danger of Connecticut's over 4,000 dams. And now, back to Colin.
So I'm here in the beautiful Yale studios in New Haven with Stephen Schwartz. They're really nice, aren't they?
I mean, they are nice, actually, once you figure out where to park.
Right. The parking might be a little bit of a challenge. But obviously, Rags is what we've been talking about here. We're going to talk a little bit about it at the end of this conversation again. Rags is playing right now at Goodspeed. And then you get on a plane and you fly to the Silicon Valley. You can see Prince of Egypt on stage. And you just keep moving around seeing Stephen Schwartz musicals as they're either revived or revised or whatever as we go everywhere. So, you know, if people say to me, who's Stephen Schwartz, I'd say he's a guy who writes music, he writes musicals. But of late, or I don't know whether it's of late or not, but at some point, you have actually written songs that do not appear in musicals. We're going to hear a little bit of one of those right now. It's called Dreamscape.
Sometimes I pause there on the threshold, afraid to leave my bright familiar home. Sometimes I spend my days running by so quickly, I don't see the doors at all. Step on through, reluctant pilgrim. my fear is all I've got to lose. Life is nothing, nothing but a dreamscape, and the dream is mine to choose.
So this is the title of this album comes from this song, Reluctant Pilgrim. This is an album of your songs that aren't not from musicals. Were they just written as songs, or the songs that didn't make it into musicals?
No, virtually all of them were just written as songs. I should point out that the version you played is not me. It's actually Telly Leung,
a
wonderful singer who was in both Wicked and the revival of Godspell. Some years ago, I have a very good friend named John Bacchino, who I think is a great songwriter, and I was sort of challenging him to consider writing for musical theater. He ultimately did a Broadway show called A Catered Affair and has done some other musical theater. And he turned the challenge around and said, well, why don't you ever just write songs out of your own experience that aren't from musicals? And it was something I never really had done. So, I took the challenge and I wound up writing a few songs. And then some people heard them and liked them. And I wound up doing actually a couple of albums of these songs, and then people sing them in cabarets, or good singers like Telly record them. So that's been nice too. They're just like little stories that aren't connected to musicals.
Are there singers that you, I don't know, has Audra McDonald covered a Stephen Schwartz?
The only recording that, or the only song I know of mine that Audra's covered is a very peculiar sort of version of Proud Lady that she put together. I admire Audra very much, and I'd love her to do more of my songs, but thus far that's the one she's done.
I want to talk to you. I want you to talk me out of a point of view. No, you can do it. So I look at the stuff that's coming to Broadway soon, and I just want to blow my brains out.
Really?
I mean, there's a
gym. Have you seen The Band's Visit?
Everybody says that's fabulous.
It's so good.
There are things that are there. But I was looking at musicals that are coming up. There's going to be a Jimmy Buffett musical. There's going to be a SpongeBob musical. There's going to be a Mean Girls musical. There's going to be a Frozen musical. There's something called Rocktopia that has Mozart, Queen, Journey, Beethoven, Pink Floyd. Down the road, I hope you're not attached to these projects. There's an Archie's musical.
I'm not attached to any of them.
And a Beetlejuice musical that's coming. And I'm thinking, how does Fun Home or anything like, or Dear Evan Hansen, how does it even get to Broadway? There's like all this stuff there.
But you know what? They do get to Broadway, and that's the point. Of course, there are always going to be projects that are commercially driven, that look safe from the outside, and some of them are safe, and some of them become big hits like Jersey Boys or Beautiful, but then other jukebox musicals don't become big hits, you know. But in the meantime, Dear Evan Hansen gets produced and Come From Away gets produced. And, you know, I don't know what you thought of them, but I thought they were both excellent shows. Fun Home gets on. Next to Normal gets on. So, I mean, I think that's what's encouraging, that there remains room for really good work, well-written musicals play with the form, maybe advance the form a little bit. If we were only seeing, you know, jukebox musicals and things that were sort of pre-sold, I would join you in your discouragement. But actually, I feel as if we're not, and there's more opportunity than ever for new writers who have talent and have something to say.
All right, Stephen Schwartz has mismanaged the clock. And so I just want to say, first of all, you must be so excited to have Rags up and running at good speed in a way that I think gratifies you a lot more than ever before.
It is so gratifying, you know, to have this show now finally doing, at least as it seems from the audience response, doing what we always hoped for it to be funny and entertaining and moving and make people think about things and be a musical that works. I really could not be more excited about it.
How many times have you seen it at Good Speed?
Oh, several times, it's been in previews, and of course we've been doing work on it. It's only just been, as we say, frozen.
Right. But it's not the musical Frozen.
No, not the musical Frozen. The fact that we're not making changes.
That could be very confusing.
It could
be. Well, I want to first of all thank you for coming down here to New Haven. And thanks to the people at the Yale Studios, too. This was great. Fun to visit here. We're going to go out with the song Rags because, of course, why not?
Because we can. Thank you, Colin.
Thank you.
It was great to talk to you.
All the while, sowing, ever were sewing hacks. We'll turn to hags. It happens bit by bit.